two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Why, hello there. It's your old pal, Sarah Silverman, and I'm back with a brand new season of the Sarah Silverman Podcast. On my podcast, I am talking about everything. Politics? Yeah, we get into it. Favorite sandwich shop in L.A.? I know a few spots, and I'm going to tell you about them. I'm also going to be talking to you. I will be reacting and responding to listener voicemails in real time. Let me tell you, things can get weird, and I love every second of it. Weird is my comfort zone. The newest season of the Sarah Silverman Podcast is out now wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada.
Hey, Last Day listeners. This is David Smith, host of The Cost of Care. You might remember me from episode 21 of Last Day, season 1, called The Blame Game, which is a great episode, not just because I'm on it, but because it really gets to the heart of how corporate greed ended up driving and laying the groundwork for the opioid crisis in the first place. So I definitely suggest you go back and give it a listen. Today, we're revisiting episode 3 of Last Day, season 1, called And Now We Rewind the Tape. And this episode is so powerful because it really gets at the heart of something we all do when we've lost our person, and that's to reflect back on the past and look for clues or evidence or any kind of information that might give us a sense of the why. And having lost 3 family members some time ago, I have spent a lot of my adult life rewinding the tape and examining every facet of my individual interactions with my family, their interactions with each other, different circumstances that were occurring in the house at the time. And certainly found some of those breadcrumbs that are connected to the why. I've also, though, found myself in recent years fast-forwarding the tape. And as I have 3 young children now, I spend much, much more of my time thinking about the environment we're creating for those 3 little people, what the next opioid epidemic might be or might look like, and how I might try to create the right set of environmental circumstances or conditions to help keep them safe. Rewinding the tape it's part of our healing process. It's part of how we learn. It's part of how we grow. It's part of how we make sense from something that we may have not lived ourselves, but where we respect and understand the profound power of those things over our loved ones. And so it's important. It's important to be able to have those opportunities. And then it's important to put our learnings in the context of the science and the evidence and the things that we know and understand. And then as we move forward in our lives, to be able to appropriately fast forward the tape, to anticipate dangers to ourselves, to our family, to our children, as we continue to navigate a crisis that has really not abated over the last 2 or 3 years. I find Last Day to be one of the most courageous, candid, and important series we probably have on humanity, on public health. And this episode in particular is so important because it helps us take the humanity involved with rewinding the tape and juxtaposing that against the science, which really does really has begun to view addiction not just as a disease, but as a chronic disease, and something that should invoke our compassion and our sympathies and our desire to connect empathically with our loved ones. So take the time to follow what's going on in the news, how your community might be impacted, how you might be able to mobilize around the issue in ways that are important and meaningful to you, or that might honor loved ones or family members who are burdened under the same disease, or whom you've perhaps lost. And collectively, we can do a tremendous amount of work over the next few years to stem this crisis. Not just for the people in our lives today, but as we fast forward the tape, for the loved ones that we know we want to protect tomorrow. I hope you get a lot out of the listen of this episode, and that it will connect with you and the ways in which it connected with me.
I saw him just sitting in there, head back, kind of mouth open. And I just said to him, "What's going on?" And he's like, "Nothing, Ma, nothing." And I'm like, "Steph, are you using heroin?" And he said, "You don't want to know." And I said, "I already know."
From the moment you find out that your person is using opioids, you start bracing yourself for disaster. You develop a palpable fear around normal, everyday things. You fear the doorbell. You fear the telephone.
I got a call at 11:30 at night from his dad crying that he died. And I didn't understand. I was sleeping and I thought maybe he was dreaming.
This is Doreen Cordova. We met her son Stefano in our last episode when we walked through his last day.
I said, "You need to hang up and take a deep breath and call me back, because I don't understand what you're saying to me." He kept telling me that he died. And so he called me back and said he couldn't get Jess on the phone. And I had to, you know, make some calls. And it was the worst day of my life.
Those calls Doreen made? One was to Jess, Stefano's sister, and my behind-the-scenes partner on this show.
The moment I found out he had died, it was 1 o'clock in the morning. My stepmother was the first person in our immediate family to find out, and she called my father, and my father called my mother, and no one could reach me because I was sleeping and my phone was off. So my mother called my in-laws, who live close by, and they drove over in the middle of the night and came into our house, and I was deep asleep, and I heard my father-in-law call for us, and the first thing I thought was, "My God, something happened to my mother-in-law." And then I heard her voice and I said, "Is everything okay?" And they said, "No, Stefano Jr. is dead." And I kind of collapsed and I said, "I was expecting this, or I was waiting for this."
I'm Stephanie Whittles-Wax, and this is Last Day. When your person dies of an overdose, the very first thing that happens, before the denial and the grief fog and the keening, is that you hear the news that they've died. And time stops. Your world collapses. You're changed. In an instant. In one moment, reality is as you know it, and in the next, it's not. And then, naturally, you rewind the tape. You replay scenes from various stages of your lives together. You ask yourself over and over again, "What could I have done differently? Yesterday, last week, last year, in college, high school, childhood." Did you put too much responsibility on them?
I went to my son and I said, "Listen, I know you're only 16. I know you can drive. I need you to take over all my chef teams."
Stefano, who we met in the last episode, was in fact Stefano Cordova Jr. This is Senior. When Stefano Jr. was growing up, his dad was working as a corporate chef, catering big events, golf tournaments, tennis matches, and Senior would sometimes ask Junior to step in. Was that it?
15, 16, 17 years old kid, you know, walking the U.S. Open where you have to deal with the top creme of the people in the world.
Or maybe it was kind of the opposite. Maybe he wasn't involved in his son's life enough.
Plus, my job was very demanding in terms of travel and not spending too much time with the family. Actually, I overworked. That's one of my biggest regrets, that I overworked at that time.
Or maybe it was the divorce when Stefano was 14.
And, you know, I started to get in trouble here and there and so forth. I started to feel the distance and the fear of losing him.
Stefano Sr. did talk to Stefano Jr. about using drugs. He'd seen addiction take over his friends as a kid in Italy.
When I grew up in Rome, I know I left all my friends same age with, you know, smoking a couple of joints here. By the time I came back, like a few years later, everybody was on heroin or cocaine and so forth. And 2 years later, I would say 99% had died.
And yet, Stefano went from smoking weed in high school and college to using Oxy in his 20s and then on to heroin when he started to run out of money.
Later on, Tony told me that he was using heroin because he was almost broke and heroin is cheaper and $5 to get a bag. I said, well, listen, there is only one thing that you can do, and that's move with me.
Move home, he means.
I didn't mind if he lived with me for the rest of his life. You know, I enjoyed him.
Stefano Sr. and Doreen, Stefano's mom, they helped Stefano through a series of rehabs. When Stefano Jr. was living in Florida before moving out to Boston, his dad would come with him to NA meetings and sit outside, waiting for him, to literally fend off the dealers who stalk the meetings. Because they know that's where people struggling with addiction are. That's where the business is. Stefano tried taking responsibility for managing his son's finances for a while. Junior asked for this, by the way, handed over his savings and told him to keep them safe. Because he knew that if it was in his hands, he'd spend it on drugs.
And then I got a call from him that he was in trouble with money, that, you know, he almost got arrested.
Again, Dad said, come home. Again, Stefano said, no, no, I'm good, Dad, I'm getting it together. And Stefano Sr. basically thought that was bullshit. But he gave the money back.
I can't leave with the risk that you're going to commit a crime, go to jail or whatever it is, or, you know, get hurt in one way or the other because you have no money, you know, to pay for the rent or to pay for, you know, to sustain yourself or whatever it is. So I just released the money to him again. And I probably kept him safe for a few years. Kept it safe.
In the months before Stefano Jr. died, he and his dad had entered a new phase of their relationship.
A grown-up relationship I had over the last 4 months. I never had that kind of grown-up where, you know, he was actually guiding me and all of a sudden this, and was very unexpected for me. But, you know, I cherished the last few months because it went from him dependent on me having a wonderful one-to-one relationship with him.
And also, Junior had been struggling. He was trying to stick with rehab and therapy, getting a Vivitrol shot, but also using and hiding that from his parents.
His word was always, don't tell my father, don't tell my father. You know, people say, my father's going to come here and kidnap me and take me back with him.
And Stefano Sr. says, yeah, you're damn right. He would have. If he'd known. But he didn't.
That hurts. That hurts me a lot. Because, you know, especially in the last few months, we got so close every day. You caught me almost every day. And, you know, look what I'm doing. You know, I'm getting all these accounts. I'm being so successful. I was so proud of him. But I said, you know, I keep telling him, if you stay in Boston, you're going to die. He said, no, Pam, I'm clean. I'm clean. I said, no. You, nobody's clean from heroin. But, you know, he was happy, so I didn't want to, you know, force him. But if I knew that, you know, a few weeks before he died, he had an overdose and nobody told me, and I still regret. I still regret that.
I get these regrets. I really do. I have these regrets about Harris. Not that I wanted to kidnap him and lock him in my basement. I mean, I live in Texas and I don't have a basement, but you know, something like that. Maybe an attic, my attic, or his attic, or maybe not even an attic at all. Just moving in with him, into his guest room. He had a very comfortable bed in there, and just hanging out there with him as long as it took, indefinitely, forever, being a 5-foot-tall bodyguard to my 30-year-old brother. In theory, solid plan. Sounds like a plan. Be there for your person, thick and thin. In reality, it's bonkers and impossible. For me, and for most people with lives, jobs, families, mortgages, how do you do that? Like, logistically. When Harris checked into rehab for the first time, I had a 1-month-old baby at home who I was literally nursing from my body. By the time he checked into the last rehab, his final rehab, that baby was 12 months old. My family lived in Houston, Texas, nearly 2,000 miles away from LA. You can't really shut down your life to save theirs. But it doesn't stop you from wishing you could. For Doreen, Stefano Jr.'s mom, her regrets and questions and what-ifs go even further.
When he was born, he was exhausted.
Yes, to birth.
It was an emergency C-section because his heartbeat was lost. He was a bigger baby than my first, and so they thought a C-section was best. He had huge shoulders. And so when I got to hold him, I was drowsy. He was sound asleep. And then we looked at each other and, you know, held him for hours. And I just will never forget the feeling, you know, the feeling of holding your child and the bonding and, you know, just the dreams and, you know, that you just want to be there for them. This was before I had any idea about any issues with, you know, drugs or, you know, he was a baby. But, I mean, he was introduced to, you know, medication before, you know, in the womb. So, you know, of course, I feel even guilty about that piece. You know, are C-section babies more vulnerable to, you know, issues?
I need to jump in here and just note that there is no evidence that babies born via C-section are more prone to opioid addiction. But this is how crazed you get. You examine everything.
You know, he was a really good baby.
Pretty decent teenager too, actually.
He confessed to me about everything in life. I colored out of the line. I failed a test, which he never failed a test.
I love that she has to clarify that, in fact, this is a bad example because he never failed a test. But anyway.
Or, you know, I did something wrong. He would confess things to me. Oh, I got a speeding ticket, or, you know, the girl I was dating, you know, we broke up. And, you know, so he wasn't a person who didn't talk to me.
Reading the tea leaves. Did we not talk enough? No, we talked. Did we not confront the addiction directly? No. Doreen is a planner. And when she found out Stefano was using heroin, she sat him down and said, look, we need a plan.
Let's figure out what's your plan to get better. And I woke up that morning and he wrote me a letter, and it said the plan. And then he has a list of things, you know, he's going to find a sponsor, get a job. And then, you know, it went on to say eat healthy, ride a bike, you know, and he bought a bike then. He was riding every day. I mean, his was so amazing.
If only a bike ride was the answer. Except a bike ride can't rewire your brain. When we come back, we turn from self-flagellation to science. Stick with us.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
People love to pretend that there are simple formulas for living your best life now. Eat this and you won't get sick. Manifest it and everything will work out. But there are some things you can choose and some things you can't. And it's okay that life isn't always getting better. I'm Kate Bowler, and on Everything Happens, I speak with kind, smart, funny people about life as it really is. Beautiful, terrible, and everything in between. Let's be human together. Everything Happens is available wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back. I'm Stephanie Whittles-Wax, and this is Last Day. So my mom is part of a support group in Texas for people who lost their loved ones to overdoses. She started the group, actually. After Harris died, this therapist tried to send her to a suicide support group, and she was like, this is sad, but this isn't really the same thing. So she started her own group. She's been doing it for 3.5 years now. At first, there were maybe 5 people who showed up. Now there's usually a crowd. I went with her recently. Good times, let me tell you.
You know, I used to have these, not even dreams, I was awake, but these dreams where he died, like all the time.
Well,
I had this all the time. It's like,
I went through his funeral numerous times before it actually occurred.
When the word heroin came out of his mouth, we knew that this wasn't gonna end well.
When my kids were really little, I would tiptoe into their rooms at night to check that they were okay. Put my hand right in front of their tiny mouths, make sure they were still breathing. For parents of people who are struggling with addiction, you're doing that when your kid is 25.
Even when Travis was home, I'd run up when he was sleeping. I'd run upstairs to his room in the morning and make sure he's okay.
Yeah.
And I would go over and listen to make sure I can still hear him breathing. And I don't know how many times the thought crossed my mind.
Yeah.
And those late nights, and in the days too, you're just wondering, how the fuck did this happen? And also, honestly, at least for me, what the fuck is wrong with him? Why? Why did he do this? And sometimes you get an answer.
I had a heart-to-heart with my son about 4 years before he died. And I woke him up at 5 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, which is the time I get up, and I just said, there's no distractions, it's just him and I. And I got some insight the first time into the torment he was under. And he just looked me in the eye and he said, you have no idea how I feel inside. He said, the demons inside me are just tearing me apart. And I looked at him and I could see into his soul at that moment. And I got this overwhelming feeling like, oh my God, what's going on in him? I probably have no way to take that pain away from him. I just realized it's almost like seeing the devil. It really brought the hairs on my neck to stand up because I realized He had no power over it, and it was in control of his life, and he knew it was in control of his life, and he couldn't stop what he was doing.
I had this idea of what the meeting would be like. Lots of tears and tissue boxes, pure sorrow. What I didn't expect was the anger, the palpable anger that these parents felt. Not at their children, but at the system. The anger was front and center.
The government doesn't want to hear my story.
Yeah. How do you change that?
I mean, Sam Snodgrass writes extensively about this stuff. He knows what to do. Nobody asked him to be on the committee. They should have asked him to be on the committee.
Well, he was a heroin addict.
Yeah. And he knows.
He has a PhD in pharmacology.
Yeah. He knows what doesn't work and what could work.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's been there.
When I told my mom I was doing a podcast about the opioid crisis, the first thing she said, well, after asking me why she wasn't hosting the show, is that I needed to touch base with Sam Snodgrass. So when a second person brought him up at the meeting, I knew I had to talk to this guy.
I started shooting heroin back in 1976 when I was 20 years old and a sophomore at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. And I loved it, but for the next 13 years, I just used occasionally.
That is Sam Snodgrass. He's a behavioral pharmacologist with a doctorate in biopsychology. Simply put, he studies how drugs affect our brains and our behavior. And for Sam, that love did not immediately tip over into crisis. Despite his occasional use of heroin, he was, in fact, doing pretty well.
Whenever I had a spring break, summer break, whatever, I'd come back to Little Rock, I'd shoot delight with my friends, and then go back to Georgia and forget it. After I finished my PhD, I was awarded a National Institute on Drug Abuse postdoctoral fellowship in pharmacology and toxicology. It's a three-year fellowship. And I came back to the pharmacology toxicology department at the University of Arkansas for medical sciences. And while I was there and doing research with these drugs, with these substances, there was a bottle of powdered methadone hydrochloride. It was rolling around in a drawer.
Methadone, for the lay people here.
I watched that bottle of methadone hydrochloride roll around until April of 1989. One day I thought, oh, well, I wonder what that methadone would feel like. That was not one of my better ideas. I got into that methadone, and I started shooting that methadone every day. And then I started shooting it two or three times a day. Then I started increasing my dose. And the whole time I was doing this, I kept telling myself, you know, when I want to, I'll stop. When I finish this bottle, I'm done. I'll stop. And I really believed that right up until the time I couldn't stop. And I tried. I tried as hard as I could. I tried with everything that I was to stop, and I couldn't.
Okay, so when you say that you tried, what does that look like?
Yeah, it's called failure. In your head, you're saying, I'm not going to use, and then you use. It was the most mystifying thing to me in my life, why I couldn't control my own behavior. I mean, come on, I'd always been able to accomplish what I set out to accomplish in my life. I can remember, you know, there's so many times, just driving up to an ATM, and all the time I'm driving up to this ATM, I'm telling myself, I can't do this, I can't make my house payment, I can't freaking make my car payment, I can't do this. Sliding my card into the ATM, punching the numbers, all the time cursing myself for doing this, getting the money, and then going and shooting the Dilaudid.
What is this word you're saying? What, it's Dilaudid? What is it?
Dilaudid is hydromorphone. It's very similar to heroin. It produces very similar effect. It just doesn't last as long as heroin. So we would say it doesn't have the legs that heroin has. But it produces one incredible rush when you shoot it.
At what point did you decide that you needed to get help in some way? What did that look like? And were you successful, quote unquote?
Okay.
I love the laughter. Let me explain
it's,
to you.
It's just, no, you don't understand.
I don't. 20,
okay. I got on a methadone clinic and I stabilized on that methadone. And I led a pretty good life. I went and started teaching out of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. I got strung out on methadone. And yet here I was using methadone to stabilize an addiction. Whether a drug produces addiction or stabilizes an addiction is not an inherent property of the drug, but it's rather in how we use it. I did well when I was on the methadone clinic, but I screwed up and got my ass kicked out. Every now and then I would take a benzodiazepine, I think it was Xanax, and they had a zero tolerance policy. And one time when I went in to get my methadone, they decided to give me a urine screen, and it popped up with the benzo, and they kicked me out. Anyway, I said when I got through with that, I was going to quit. I was going to stop. I was done with it. No more. Of course, I didn't stop. I started shooting the Oxy-80s. I don't remember this, but I was told that I was going into class, and I'm trying to teach and nodding out my desk, nodding out standing up. I got kicked out of UALR in the spring semester of 2009. After that, I lost my home, my car. I lost everything. I was homeless, penniless kind of thing. I was sleeping on the ground in homeless shelters. The last about 3 months of my addiction, I was living with this family. They were very good to me. They tried to help me. I was sleeping on their floor, but heck, they slept on the floor half the time. It didn't matter. The grandmother was selling Dilaudid, Roxy's, methadone, wherever she could out the front door. This is literal. Her son-in-law and grandsons were selling crack out the back door. And it was just 24 hours a day chaos in that house. It was just almost impossible to be able to live there. But again, it was a roof over my head, and they were good to me. They fed me. I didn't pay rent. And I'd been there for about 3 months, and I didn't have anywhere to go. The only thing I could think to do was go to a detox and to try and get my tolerance down. I wasn't thinking about quitting. I was going to go to a detox and just, you know, get my tolerance down to where when I went back out on the streets, it would be better for me. Wouldn't cost as much.
The lower your tolerance, the less you need to get high. The less it costs to get high.
Anyway, I went to this detox. I was sick as I could be. But this detox place had it worked out to where I could go to a place called Hoover, which was your basic 12-step religious-based rehab. Luckily, it was only about 8 blocks from the rehab, so I could walk there. I didn't have a car. I hadn't had a car in years. And I can't say that Hoover did much for me, except it gave me a place to stay out of the weather. This was December in Arkansas. I had no money. I had no friends left. I'd burned every bridge that you could possibly burn. Nobody knew if I was alive or dead. Nobody really cared. And after 28 days in Hoover, you could leave what they called the campus, which was really just an old church building that flooded when it rained. But you could leave the campus, and luckily, University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences, UAMS, was about 10 blocks from Hoover. And so what I did was when I was able to leave, I went to the library at UAMS, and I started reading about opioid addiction. I started reading about what they had learned about the changes within the brain that produce opioid addiction. And it clicked. I finally understood why I couldn't stop. I finally understood why I fought myself like I did and kept losing. This is an acquired disease of brain structure and function. They say knowledge is power. Well, it was this knowledge, nothing I got out of that damn rehab. It was this knowledge, I think, which has helped me to not use up until this point.
Okay, this is important. This is so important. Sam kept fighting himself and losing because he had a disease, an acquired disease of brain structure and function. And knowing that literally changed his life.
This is a chronic illness. Right now, my addiction is in remission. I am not cured. I am not recovered. I'm not even in recovery. My addiction is in remission. I can't promise you that next week or next month or next year, I won't be using again. This can come back. I can have a recurrence of this disorder anytime. There is no such thing really as addiction, just as there is no such thing really as cancer. There are many different forms of cancer, each with a specific form of treatment. The same thing with addiction. There are different forms of addiction, and each one has its own specific form of treatment. This is not a one-size-fits-all kind of thing. Because, again, this is not about willpower. It's not about being a good or bad person. It's not about wanting to quit. If we could quit when we wanted to quit, there wouldn't be a problem. This is about having people get their lives back and understanding that these medications, they're not a crutch.
He's talking about medications like buprenorphine, Suboxone, and methadone. Medications that are often used to help people stay sober. It's called medically assisted treatment, or MAT, and it's backed by a thing called science.
This is where these medications are so important, and to try and get rid of the stigma around them, because they reduce all-cause mortality, particularly overdose deaths, decreased by 50 to 75% with people who are taking medication. We could save so many lives if we could just get rid of this stupid idea that these medications aren't as good as going to AA or NA. Abstinence-based methods, they may work very well for other forms of, let's say, alcohol use or meth or I don't know, and I don't really care. What I care about right now is that most of the people dying in this country are dying because of opioid overdose, and we have medications that would keep them alive. And yet we restrict access to them, we stigmatize them, and we tell people, oh no, don't use those medications, go to some rehab that will put you through abstinence-based treatment. When you come out of jail, when you come out of detox, when you come out of prison, you have no tolerance. Your tolerance is gone, it's zip, it's done. And you could use what you think is a safe dose, and it may not be.
This is why my brother's dead. This is exactly why, because he would relapse every single day that he got out of rehab, three times.
Yes, of course.
He relapsed that day.
The problem is that no one's ever told us that this is an acquired disease of brain structure and function, and that tolerance is a sign, a signal, that you are actually changing the structure of your brain on a cellular, molecular level. Since we don't know that, we don't understand that. We've always been told it's a matter of willpower, it's a choice. We can stop if we want to. But really what drives us is this craving that the opioids produce. Let's say that somebody is starving for food. What are they going to be thinking about? They're going to be thinking about food. And they're going to be craving food. And the longer they go, the more they starve, the more they crave for food. Now, if they have to, are they going to steal to get money to buy food? The answer to that would be yes, because survival is not a choice. You will do what you have to do to survive. We can be starving, and if you give us a choice between heroin or food, we're going to take that heroin. That doesn't make us bad people. No, it is a completely normal, rational response to the starvation that we're feeling. This is why we do the things we do in our addiction. We're not bad people, but we're in an unwinnable situation. We have no power over our addiction. So robbing a drugstore really isn't that great an idea, but we're out of options, and we know it's a horrible thing to do. And if we had a choice, we wouldn't be doing these things. But again, the starvation drives us to do these things. If we had more options, if we had more power over our addiction, then we could express that power. But it's very difficult because we have such an entrenched system of beliefs and stigmatized beliefs, misinformed beliefs about opioid addiction in this country, that the Congress, instead of really looking at this as a health problem or a health condition, still has this belief that we should arrest our way out of this problem. If this worked, we wouldn't be where we're at. It doesn't work.
But there are things he believes do work.
Harm reduction is two things. Harm reduction is programs like overdose training, naloxone distribution, syringe exchange programs. It's medications to treat opioid addiction, methadone and buprenorphine. It would be overdose prevention sites if we could ever get them set up in this country. The purpose of the programs is to reduce the harms, is to keep people alive long enough to help them to get their life back together. You get people coming into the syringe exchange, you get people coming in for naloxone, and you start making connections with people who have no connections, whose families have abandoned them, who have been marginalized and thrown the refuse of society. But they're people. And if you treat them like people, then you can help bring them in and you can help them make changes in their lives, which will better them and better society.
These days, Sam works at a buprenorphine clinic. He spends his days educating people who are struggling with opioid use disorder about the effects of opioids and why he believes medically assisted treatment, like buprenorphine, is so critical in the recovery or remission process. That's on paper. But he does so much more than that.
I try and make them feel wanted. I try and make them feel valued. I try and make them understand that they are not bad people. We've all done bad things, but that doesn't make us bad people. And I want them to understand that these things that they carry around full of guilt, full of shame, I want them to understand that, yes, they were bad things. Don't ever forget you did them. But don't live in that area because you really didn't have an option at that point but to do those things. But now you do have an option. You're here, you can get on this buprenorphine, and you can not do those things again, and you can be the person you were meant to be.
How do you respond to somebody that tells you, my son, my husband, my daughter, my best friend, whomever, my brother, my sister, has this addiction and I want to help them and I don't know what to do? What do I do?
Well, my suggestion would be to try and find somebody who is board certified in addiction medicine, if you can, or at least try and find a buprenorphine provider within your area. If you want to keep the person you love alive, get them on a medication. If somebody has Parkinson's or multiple sclerosis, they get physical therapy, they get medications, they get motorized wheelchairs. Now, if you take those services away from those people, wouldn't they be powerless over their disease? I know people say, oh, well, you did this to yourself. You started, you know, you're the one that put the first drug in. Yeah, okay, we did. But the point is, you don't understand. Nobody understands what it's like to have an opioid addiction until you're in one. And by then, it's a little late. We know how to keep people alive. We're just not doing it.
Are there things that you can point to that makes people prone to an opioid addiction? Is it genetic? Is it, I have little kids, you know? How do I know? Like, how do I look out for this? What are the risk factors?
Being human?
Okay, thank you.
That was a short answer. Being human.
That was your shortest answer yet.
No, they're. If you have a child, if you have a loved one, or you, or whatever, you take some pain pills, or for some reason you try some heroin or some whatever, and it makes you feel better than you've ever felt before. You had better not do any more.
So really, I mean, truly, it can happen to anybody.
Yeah, I think that's the point.
Mm-hmm. Are there any statistics, Sam, about, how many people are in your boat versus how many people, I don't even know how to phrase this question. How many people can beat this thing and how many people can't?
Okay, again, I haven't beat it.
All right. I know. This is such a flaw in the way that we talk about it. It's
yes.
So ingrained.
Again, yeah, just because it's been a little over 7 years, something like that, since I've used, but again, I haven't beat this.
There may not be a way to beat it, but there are ways to treat it. to manage the symptoms, like any other medical disease. To take that first step towards remission, like Sam did. And over the course of the season, we're going to explore many of the methods and treatment options that Sam mentioned. But it's not easy. And it's not one size fits all. It's trial and error. For many, for most, a lot of error. Which doesn't make us bad. It makes us human. When Doreen, Stefano Sr., and Jess wonder how this could have happened and what they could have done differently, the short answer is nothing. Stefano died from a disease. Period. This wasn't a choice. This was not a choice. Like Sam says, it's not a life that anyone chooses. It's certainly not the life Stefano chose, not the life he wanted. He wanted that promotion at work. He wanted to start a family with Paige. He wanted to be an old man, for Halloween, at least. A few days after he died, his costume arrived.
I remember when we were cleaning out his apartment, the doorbell rang and a FedEx package arrived for him, and it was his Halloween costume, which he was planning to wear a week later. He was going to be an old man, so it was some sort of mask. I couldn't bring myself to look at it.
If you're a member of our shitty club for people who have lost people to opioids, you probably have a vivid image of what an overdose looks like. Maybe you've seen it before. Maybe you've played the scene in your head 100 times. Maybe it's the thing that keeps you up at night. And if you're not part of the club, you've definitely seen it portrayed on TV and in movies. After Stefano overdosed, his wife Paige found his body in their bathroom. She called 911. The operator told her to administer CPR until the EMTs arrived. When they finally did arrive, Paige recalls that it was all business.
They walked in and they were just like so rude. They were just like, yeah, I don't see anything. Like they don't see any breath.
Paige had just lost her husband. They were out on another job. A job that can be exhausting, unrelenting, demoralizing, and kind of like they're trapped in the movie Groundhog Day starring Bill Murray, but way less funny.
Sometimes we'll go for the same patient 3 or 4 or 5 times a day. And I think that it's frustrating for our crews at times because, you know, they just see this cycle where they go and they grab them, they do everything they can for them, they wake them back up, they get them to the hospital, and then they walk back out.
Next episode, we look at things from their perspective. Last Day is a production of Lemonada Media. It's produced by Justine Daum. Kat Aaron is our consulting producer. Jessica Cordova-Kramer is our executive producer. Mix and sound design was done by Joe Plord. Keegan Zema is our editor. Our music is by Hannes Brown. And I'm Stephanie Whittles-Wax. You can find us online at Lemonada Media. That's Lemonada like Lemonada. If you liked what you heard today, tell your family and friends to listen and subscribe. Rate and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And check out our show notes for a deeper dive into what you've heard today and how to connect with the Last Day community. See you next week.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere?
And suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time. Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people. And we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Paul F. Tompkins.
I'm Lauren Lapkus.
And I'm Scott Aukerman, and together we make up the show
Freedom!
We're comedians from Los Angeles who are also friends.
Yeah, that's weird, isn't it? And on our podcast, we just chat with each other, have fun, play games. It's just a good hang.
We just talk about everything that's happened in our lives ever before and up to now and what will happen next.
We see the future.
So the new season's out now. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts.
Wherever you get them.
Wherever.
Listen.
Wherever.
Bye.
Freedom!